It took 10 months out of my life in terms of just dealing with that, with the work involved in that case. I think it's really one of those cases that never leaves you as a prosecutor. I mean, and I think it's a case that if you ask people what they identify me as more than anything else, people will say the Beta case, because that's how they remember me.
Welcome to the Murder In Podcast, where we dig up forgotten homicide cases from rural communities, small towns, and far-off distances. Relive these violent and sometimes weird cases with the prosecution. I'm your host, Henry Valdez. I'm a writer, storyteller, and son of a district attorney who grew up watching my father try some of the most historic cases in New Mexico. It's been a long road, but we have finally reached the end. This is the conclusion of the Chimayo Massacre, the Ricky Abeita murder case. Here's episode 5. J.D. Mieta, a pastor of the Victory Faith Church in Española, visited with Ricky Abeita during the trial. Ricky's attorney, Gary Mitchell, painted a picture of a soft-spoken, reserved, but respectful man to the jury. But in all actuality, he didn't know Ricky outside the courtroom. So he asked Mr. Mieta, was he worth saving? In which the pastor replied, most definitely, everyone is. A number of friends and acquaintances spoke highly of Ricky to the Rio Grande Sun paper. One interviewee even recalled times when Ricky helped troubled young men from a nearby shelter. People knew him as a quiet, working-class young man, so it was hard to believe he committed such acts of violence. Ricky wasn't on trial for how he treated people before January 26, 1991, but rather for his actions on that tragic day. The trial lasted 2 months, but it was 10 months of tireless work for Deputy District Attorney Henry Valdez. By the time the jury entered deliberation, he was exhausted. It took the jury 11 days to reach a verdict, but it was 11 days of rest Henry hadn't had in nearly a year.
Actually, the jury deliberating that long kind of gave me a little bit of a break from having to jump just back into another case for my regular workload. So it was, in a strange sense, kind of nice for me personally that they took that long to deliberate. Now, I mean, when they do take that long, there was, of course, you know, all kinds of theories as to why they were taking that long. And because it was a high-profile case, there was still an article in every paper every day that the jury hadn't reached a verdict. And then they would have various people say, well, that means this or that means that. But, you know, for those, I think, that were close to the case, and understanding that the questions that were coming out from the jury and understanding the evidence the way we did. So I wasn't really sitting on pins and needles, you know, kind of was a little bit of a break.
The jury found Ricky guilty of 4 counts of first-degree murder for Agnesita Sandoval, Mary Ellen Sandoval, Cheryl Randon, and New Mexico State Police Officer Glenn Huber. He received 2 counts of second-degree murder for Macario Gonzalez and Ria Arriba Sheriff Deputy Jerry Martinez. He also received 1 count of voluntary manslaughter for the death of 6-month-old Justin Gonzalez. The jury found Ricky innocent on 2 counts of attempted murder and wounding Eloy Sandoval. Similar to the rest of the trial, Ricky showed no emotion as Judge Kaufman read the verdict. He was looking at a possible 149 years in prison and potential death. The guilty verdict for the first-degree murder of State Police Officer Glenn Hubert triggered the death penalty phase for the aggravating circumstances of killing a police officer in the line of duty.
the jury at that point then has to make a decision of whether the death penalty is imposed, or if they can't unanimously agree on the death penalty being imposed, then life in prison for that count is imposed. There was, from what I was told by the foreperson of the grand jury, there was 11 people that voted in favor of the death penalty right from the very get-go, and there was one person who voted against death penalty. And after she voted against the death penalty, indicated that she would not want to discuss it or talk about it anymore, and really refused to engage in any discussion with any of the jurors, because she refused to engage. After a period of time, the foreperson said, sent out a note saying, we cannot unanimously agree on the death penalty. So the judge discharges the jury, and for that count, he gets life in prison.
Ricky escaped death because of one juror out of 12. One person representing the community felt he was worth saving. It wasn't much, but it was enough for the all-or-nothing system at the time. In 2009, New Mexico became the 15th state to abolish the death penalty, regardless of any aggravating circumstances.
And I do remember, really, after it was all done, I do remember feeling at least the satisfaction that I knew he wasn't going to get out. I was really confident that he got a very fair trial, that Judge Coleman had done a really good job. And I didn't, the defense, of course, had done a great job. I didn't see that an appeals court, or in this case, since it was a first-degree murder conviction, the Supreme Court of the United States would reverse the case. So I was really confident that whatever sentence he got, he was going to serve out.
Today, Ricky serves his consecutive life sentences in prison. But throughout his time in prison, he has sparked a number of policy changes because of the uniqueness of his lack of prior convictions before the incident, his respectful and reserved demeanor combined with the absolute horror of the massacre.
Ricky Abeta continued, even after he was sentenced, to cause changes at several levels. He was originally classified as a minimum custody inmate, because at the time, all the corrections department looked at was, you know, everything was kind of one count, and he had no prior history, that any significant prior history, way less than anybody else going into the prison, that they classified him as minimum security, and that caused an uproar, just an uproar in the community. And so they felt a lot of heat, and they actually changed their classification system because of it. And one of the other things that it did is the way corrections determines somebody's sentences, they go by counts. So in Ricky Abeta's case, he served count one first. Count one, if you all recall, was the Macario Gonzalez count. And I say that because we charged in what we thought was the chronological order of what occurred. And so Macario would have been the first one that was shot. And so we put that as count one. Well, that was one of the second degree murder counts that he was convicted of. And you could earn good time on that. And so he was up for parole from count one, about 5 years after he began his sentence. And so that caused another uproar, because pursuant to the Victims of Crime Act, all the letters went out to all the family members or survivors that he was coming up for parole here, and they just couldn't believe it. But the fact of the matter is, he was coming up for parole hearing. The thing was, he was then paroled into count two. which was one of his life sentences. And, you know, he'll come up for a hearing on that probably fairly, you know, within the next couple of years or so. But I don't think he'll ever be paroled from that count. If he is, he's paroled to count three, which will be another life sentence. So he'd have to do another 30 years before he can come up for a parole hearing on that. So he's there, but it did cause a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear in some of the victims that he was getting out so quick. So those are some of the things that that happened even after he was sent away.
31 years have fallen off the calendar, yet many New Mexicans recall this case as if it happened last week. As our episodes rolled out, several people from northern New Mexico reached out, sharing their feelings and emotions as they witnessed the events unfold through the media coverage at the time. For Henry, the memories are vivid, but they're ones he didn't wish to recall on a more profound and personal level until now.
I've been asked to do stuff like this similarly. I was even asked by an author to write a book. I had been interviewed by several magazines. I chose to do one interview with American Lawyer. They had done, I was approached by television stations to do, you know, these specials. I hadn't really wanted to talk about it, and I haven't really talked about it. Part of it is that I try to be as respectful to the victims as I can. They're the one group of people that are always overlooked in any of these crime stories. And so I didn't want to contribute to that.
On June 2nd, 1992, 7 months removed from the Ricky Abeita trial, my father held me up in celebration as Julie Graber snapped a photo to appear on the front page of the New Mexican the next day. The photo is the most significant representation of my early life. At 6 years old, I stared directly into the lens, smiling with my hands around my dad's neck as he held me up enthusiastically after receiving results from the election count. I wore a cartoon Rocketeer t-shirt paired with acid-wash jeans. Our family and friends celebrated my father's victory after a three-way race for district attorney. He was 34 years old and had accomplished a lifetime's worth of achievements for a prosecutor. Now, I was a district attorney's son, a distinction that defined my childhood and adolescence. The Ricky Abeita case was a distinction of his career at that point. It tested him as a prosecutor and a community leader and changed his perspective on domestic violence. The lessons he learned from the case played out over the 40-year career as a prosecutor in New Mexico.
After Ricky Abeita, I ran for district attorney. One of my pledges to the public was to deal with domestic violence, you know, as much as we could before we end up with the Ricky Abeita situation. And so I established the first family violence unit in the first judicial district. And I just didn't, you know, put a lawyer with one support staff, or I started the unit with seven staff members, three attorneys, victim advocates, and two support staff. And I also gave them an investigator to work with them when they needed investigation. And so I addressed it in a serious manner off the bat with the hopes of catching it, that misdemeanor that happens before the killing, and addressing it at that point. And, you know, it was very treatment oriented, the program was. To try and get it to the point where these types of situations wouldn't happen. And so it did shape my thinking. And by Ricky Abeita, I had been a prosecutor close to 10 years. I had tried probably by that point in my career hundreds of cases, including domestic violence cases, you know, several homicides before that. But it really changed the way I looked at domestic violence from that point on, to the point where even today in my position as the director of the administrative office of district attorneys, where I'm in, I get to set the training curriculum for the prosecutors in the state of New Mexico. And we have a conference now that's dedicated to domestic violence. So I think it has shaped my thinking and the way I look at domestic violence crimes.
It was an incredible journey into the past as we dug up memories of a case that affected many of us. I hope we told a story that was bold, honest, and true. But above all, I hope we honored the heroes of January 26, 1991. Everyone there on that Chimayo property acted bravely in their actions. Life is a web of connections between individuals that we can't see with the naked eye. Only when we look beneath the surface can we catch a glimpse of the roots of human existence. This podcast is about those roots.
I wouldn't want anybody to think Ricky Abeita's a hero, like you get, you know, with some of these famous killers, because he's not a hero. You know, I don't want anybody to think I was a hero, because I was just doing my job. The heroes were Glenn Huber. The heroes were Jerry Martinez. The heroes were Peter Martinez. Heroes were Eloy Sandoval. Those are the heroes. You know, we played our part, and I was, you know, a major player maybe in playing our part. I wasn't a hero. And I just want to leave with that, that those were the true heroes of that day.
I want to thank all of you for giving us a chance and listening to our independent podcast. I also want to thank my mother for pushing me to create podcasts to get these important stories out there. And my wife for encouraging me to keep things moving forward, even when the nights were long and things got tough. Finally, I want to thank my father for opening up and letting us in by retelling a part of his life that was buried away in memories and emotions from long ago. Also, please consider contributing to domestic violence nonprofits that aid domestic violence survivors and help people out of very tough situations. Next season on The Murder Inn, we'll examine another case in another place that people forgot long ago. See you then.